I'm Bruce Lundy, and I work at MSA Professional Services, and I've been doing marina and waterfront design for the last 25 years. And I'd like to talk a little bit today about resilience in the age of climate change. Today we're going to discuss how the industry is handling the environmental changes we're experiencing at inland waterfront facilities. I'm not going to go coastal on it because that's a larger subject and I'm not as well versed in it. Since the marina facilities expansion of the 60s and 70s, when fiberglass boats came into the fore and middle-class boaters started springing up everywhere, we've seen many problems overcome, and our products and standards have evolved to meet the industry's needs to manage the challenges of climate change. For marinas and waterfront facilities, designers have had to deal with the elements for a long time. Today's presentation will illustrate the problems and how some designers have learned to manage these effects. This happens to be a marina that I'm closely associated with in Alton, Illinois, and this was June 2nd of 2019. What do we do when the weather rules change? Well, it's a serious and emotional topic that some politicians like to beat people over the head with, even admitting that climate change is happening. But in the design community, we begin by learning how to design to accommodate these changes and manage those issues that we can and understand those things we cannot control and try to work around them. The climate change has impacted our marinas in quite a few ways. For our lakes and rivers, it means having to modify our understanding of the limits of these water bodies. Much of our understanding involves the changes in wind, temperature, and precipitation, and the one that's most impactful to us has been precipitation. With the change in our climate, we've seen wilder swings in rainfall, and we've seen a lot more flooding potential, and we've seen a lot of drought conditions too. Just to put it into perspective, these little panels here illustrate in 10-year increments the amount of change in precipitation in these various regions. The little green stripes are the increases, the brown stripes are the decreases, and the only one area that we've seen a consistent decrease has been Hawaii. Out in the Pacific, it's having its issues too. Fortunately, I'm not dealing with it today. But the eastern half of the United States, where we are right now, has seen the most significant changes in very heavy precipitation. As we see here in this graph, the Northeast has increased the percentage of precipitation by 71%, which is a phenomenal number. But if you've been watching the news from time to time, you will see that part of the country, along with the Southeast, has had much more in flash flooding and in high river flooding and in issues that we frankly didn't have to deal with as much as we used to. What we have for references in the design community has been the FEMA maps and the Corps of Engineers predictions on flood frequencies in either 10, 50, or 100-year increments up to 500-year predictions. And we're finding that they're dated now. We're having a lot of trouble keeping up with the changes that have happened. And although FEMA has been making improvements in their floodplain mapping and some of their other tools, it's still behind the curve. Our USGS seems to be working a little quicker than them on improving the tools for prediction, and we are starting to use them more regularly. For our lakes and rivers, Lake Michigan and even Lake Superior in the 1990s and the the 2000s was experiencing record lows, and people were claiming that because they dredged the St. Clair River back in the 1980s that it was draining the Great Lakes. Well, there wasn't a whole lot of science behind that. It was part of the long-term cyclic nature of the lakes. But what we're experiencing in the last decade or so is an extreme high water. These charts that you see here are produced by the Corps of Engineers, and they are basically documenting what's going on and what they predict to go on for the next 6 months. As you see on the blue line, that's the average. It's a long-term average by month. And then the little black lines, top and bottom, are the record highs and lows for that month. And the red line is our most recent years. And as you see on Lake Michigan, we hit a peak in July that tied the record. And where it normally goes down at a pretty swift rate in the fall, hasn't dropped as much as we expected it to. The prediction is that this winter we will break records for midwinter lake elevations. Now, this has a lot of implications, not just for marinas, but for shorelines and for behaviors of breakwaters and the like. On Lake Superior, it's even worse. Normally, you have a 4-foot excursion between record high and record low for any particular month. And this entire summer, we broke the records in May, June, July, tied in August and September, and are pretty darn close to the record right now. What we've seen on the news in Wisconsin, which is where I'm from, is that a lot of the shoreline structures are being destroyed or damaged, and a lot of the shoreline is being eroded at a great rate. What you see on this chart also is the green line is the prediction for the next 6 months. It's going to stay very close to those record elevations for the short-term foreseeable future. So what are we doing about it? Well, the industry has a pretty good handle on what the core parameters are right now for the 10, 50, 100, and 500-year floods. But we're getting more conservative as we go through this process. We're taking their extremes and we're adding a little bit of conservatism to them just to cover our liability basis, for lack of a better term for it. Our designs are getting taller, deeper, and more substantial in their resilience to these effects. And we've learned to discount the locals' anecdotal evidence that it can't happen here. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But we're in our long-term approach design, we're counting on higher highs and lower lows. Even though we have more extreme rain events in the east half of the United States, we also have sequences where we have extended periods of no rain and we have low water conditions that also have to be accounted for in our design. I'm going to show now a couple of our projects that we've accomplished in the last couple decades and how they've managed to use newer techniques to sustain themselves. In Alton, Illinois, I had the honor of being hired to manage the design process in early 1994, right after the Great River Flood of 1993. Alton is just north of St. Louis and was basically the ground zero for the flooding event there. Their flooding at the city was 28 feet above normal pool, and it had significant impacts on the levee, flooded the downtown, and generally made a giant mess out of everything. When I got hired on, we had no trouble convincing the city fathers and mothers to go with the 500-year predictions as our design basis. They'd just gone through it. They they had nobody there saying that it can't happen there here anymore because they just lived through it. What we did is we developed pile designs based on the full range of flood heights and flood flow related loadings. When that river floods, obviously you have a greater velocity and you have debris coming through there. You have trees, pigsties, bed mattresses, all sorts of things came down and impacted the structures along the river. We also had a covered dock system there. So normally those are connected with underwater trusses to keep the fingers from getting displaced under loads. We modified those so that in low water conditions, they would collapse upwards and allow the marina to function under low water conditions without trapping the boats. And then we decided to make everything that floated, or everything that was vulnerable, to either be floating or flood resilient. And finally, we developed a technique of moving all the vulnerable utility connections. That's transformers and switchgear and backflow preventers and all sorts of utility connections. We moved them either to the dry side of the levee or into a condition where they would be protected under flood conditions. This is a construction photo of the Alton Marina, one of the docks that was in 1995. Yes, the marina is not quite built yet, and yes, there's a boat in the marina. Some people were very enthusiastic to get this one going. And so even though we were only halfway through construction, the city decided to let a few people in just to keep the enthusiasm going. But what we did is we checked on the soils and the underwater conditions. We did underwater soil borings throughout the marina. And based on the changes that they had there, we developed full-height piles to go through that 500-year flood that were either 50, 60, or 70 feet deep to accommodate the loadings under those flood flow conditions. Remember, when you have flooding coming through and you've got boats in the marina and you've got floats in the water, every square inch that's exposed to that flow is pressing your marina downstream. So we had quite a bit going on there. And even though we weren't done with phase one, we ended up working on phase two. And the photo on the left there is what the marina looks like near A dock, the upstream end of it. And it looks pretty nice. But during the construction process, the Corps of Engineers was trying to deal with some flooding conditions upstream, and they did a technique known as tilting the pool. So the Alton Pool, which is a 30-mile-long stretch of the Mississippi River, had its floodgates open to encourage the water that was upstream to come down faster. The downside of this is it dropped the bottom out of our marina. And even though they had promised never to go below 414 elevation, this is at 412 and a half, and we're not even done with construction, we have to schedule dredging. So we learned a lesson there about expectations for water levels and to get a little more conservative with it. We determined that if you're going to have a bunch of structures like restrooms and offices and ship stores, that due to the limited amount of land on the wet side of the levee, all our buildings would have to float. And we got lucky. We'd learned about the floating structures that you see up in the Pacific Northwest, and most of them are in reinforced concrete structures that have polystyrene giving them the flotation. You know, the house in Sleepless in Seattle was part of those floating homes. And we used that to develop a series of buildings for our marina. And as you see in the photo there, that required a lot of pre-planning on your utilities, because just like a slab on grade, you got to have the pipes in the ground, or in the polystyrene in this case, before you cast the concrete. We also put together the buildings on top of the flotation systems upland. It made the construction go quicker and made the workers a lot less scared of climbing up on the platform, because if they fell off, they just hit the dirt and didn't drown. In this photo, you can see them preparing to launch these. They used house movers and local boat launch facility to launch them, which was one of the happiest days of my life. We also used those floating concrete platforms to develop a floating pool system, because a pool in the dirt upland would be destroyed in a flooding condition, because the water pressure would be encouraging it to pop up out of the dirt. So here you have the assembly process. We had a commercial aluminum swimming pool fabricated, transported to the site, floated it into three of the four platforms that formed the surrounds for the pool. It worked out pretty well. Here you see the floating restroom structure and ship store next to the floating pool in its final location. The blue barrels you see there are ballast, because we also had a hot tub on top of the deck, and until that was in place, there was too much flotation, so we had to ballast it down to keep it all level. They're gone now. We also had the opportunity to have fuel services there, both unleaded and diesel, and to solve that problem, because underground storage tanks have a tendency to want to go up when you have a flood condition. We hired a naval architect who designed floating barges, double wall barges, where the inner part of the barge held the fuel, and the outer part of the barge was set with alarms so that if there was ever any leakage from the inner tank to the outer tank, the alarms would sound and they could take care of the problem. So far, so good. And as you see on the left, we have a beautiful, beautiful marina working at near full occupancy and being successful for a couple of decades. And on the right, you have the same marina, Alta Marina, in June of this year, where we had 2.5 feet below the 1993 flood, so it's a very significant flood, about 10 feet in the parking lot. And the marina staff managed it as best as they could. What we had is, what you see in the foreground is a walkway. When a flood wasn't at its worst, you could still get to the access point and still get on your floating docks. But at the end of the day, they were using a John boat to get out there, because it just had overwhelmed that system too. We got hired after the flood to do a post-flood condition assessment. And it was a great opportunity. Most designers and engineers don't ever get to see whether their design assumptions worked or not. And I unfortunately got to do that this summer. We used our GPS team to go and do a photographic assessment and wrote a report that was used for getting funding for FEMA for damage repair. And each of those little dots is a photo. And I'm very happy to say that for the most part, this marina did extremely well. On the Alton Pool, there's about 19 other marinas, and about half of them have still not reopened. What did we find when we were there? Well, we found that we had a landscape architect who knew his business and had selected vegetation that was durable. Those are bald cypress. They were placed along the shoreline. They were underwater for the most part for over a month. And this is the photo of them after the flood. They came through in flying colors. They don't mind getting their feet wet. We had other vegetation, bushes and maples and other things that may not survive. Our horticulturist came out there and, as part of the assessment, told them that they have a 2-year limit to let them try and recover. And if they don't make it in 2 years, we just have to replace them. That was also part of the FEMA assessment. One of the things that didn't work so well is our shoreline protection. The armor stone there was undersized, and a lot of it washed out. It's unfortunate, but it's something that's repairable, and as part of the repairs for FEMA, we will be using a larger size stone and reshaping it so that it goes back to its intended function. Cleanup. That was the biggest problem we have, and it's like we said before, it's something that we couldn't avoid. When it overtops and it's muddy Mississippi, it dropped about 1.5 inches of silt on the entire upland area. We ended up using front-end loaders and the fire protection system to clean it up. A lot of trucks worth of trees, logs, debris, whatnot had to be taken care of. Again, in the design world, there are things that you just can't do much about. The other half of this is that it dropped several inches of sediment into our basement, so we will have to do some more maintenance dredging as a part of the recovery effort. Again, that's all been submitted as FEMA costs, those went in 2 months ago, and we haven't heard back on how much of it they're going to pay for, but we suspect that it's going to be the major portion of it. Other parts that we had to deal with was a lot of hand labor to clean things up, because once that silt gets in there, it gets everywhere. Fortunately, this was enamel coated and was able to be washed by hand, but stayed in pretty darn good condition. So what lessons did we learn on the Alton flood? Well, we learned that those predicted conditions can happen, and that good design can minimize the damage. We learned that the right vegetation helps. We learned that we had a little bit of damage due to debris coming down. We lost one pile bracket, got bent up, and it has to be replaced. But that, in the larger scheme of things, is pretty nominal. I'd like to touch on a couple. Yes, ma'am. Just great. Being in those double-walled tanks on piles, they just rolled up and came back down. We had one hose that is in the fuel fill system up at the upland connection that got kinked and had to be replaced. But no spills, no damage. Nope. In this case, it all came through. Again, really well. So I'm happy to report that, because I would feel awful if that hadn't succeeded. And I did learn some lessons on my connection detailing for the next time. One of the facilities that we worked on at a previous company was a park along the waterfront on the Cumberland River. This is in Clarksville, Tennessee. It's called Liberty Park. And this was a major operation. We ended up having close to 1 million cubic yards excavated to create the basin for the marina. And it was all replaced on the park site to create more out of the floodplain upland land, which you can see in that kind of blank spot over on in the middle of the photo, and created a stormwater management system that takes not only the acreage of the park, but 800 acres of off-site stormwater runoff, and treats that before it goes out to the marina. That is what that pond is in the middle of that, and surrounding it are a series of four bays that allow the sediment and the material to fall out. Then it goes into the pond. Once it gets to a certain level, there is a weir that allows it to daylight down the stream and eventually into the basin. It works really well. We still have to see how they manage the maintenance on it, but it looks like it's going to last a good long time. Just to give you a perspective of the final floodplain, that's what gets underwater in a 500-year flood. For those who don't know this area of the country, Clarksville is located between Nashville here and the land between the lakes and the Cumberland River. The star is Clarksville, of course. It's roughly halfway between, and this now becomes a destination for people who are using the river. We designed it for the 500-year flood in 2008 and 2009, started construction in 2009, and received a fair amount of static from the locals saying that it can happen here. We put in a new dam at Land Between the Lakes in 1985, and it's never come close to that. We were fortunate to be able to ignore them, because in 2010, halfway through the construction cycle, this place flooded. And let me go to that one. Oh, by the way, this is one of the structures at the park, and the lower level of that structure is within the floodplain and is flood resistant. It's got a couple of restrooms that after a flood can be hosed down and checked out and returned to service. The upper level acts as a party venue, a wedding hall, you name it, handles a couple hundred people at a time, and is all above the floodplain. In 2010, they had their 500-year flood. And just to put it in perspective, this is the chart, and on May 1st, between May 1st and May 2nd, it rose 15 feet. All told, it rose 33 feet in 4 days. And we had designed an electrical services building where the switchgear and transformers were going to be placed. It was in the middle of construction. What you see here is the formwork for the second level during the peak of the flood. One of the local officials for the city of Clarksville got out in his John Boat and took a photo because he was one of those people that had been fighting like us to get this design to manage a 500-year flood. And we were right. We were lucky and right. This is that same structure after the flood, and that lower level is for access to the switchgear rooms, but it basically encloses a stairway. And the upper level, which is all covered with the forms, is the second level where all that work happened. We also had the marina operator put his structures all on floating docks so that when the flood came, he wouldn't be damaged also. He came after the event, so he hasn't had that experience yet, but I'm pretty sure that he's got it all handled. I will touch base on one more marina that we worked on but haven't built yet. And that's in Owensboro, Kentucky. It's on the Ohio. And the Ohio at Owensboro is pretty special because it has flood heights on the level of 40 feet. And Owensboro is on a bluff on the southern bank, so the city itself is well protected. But to the north, into Indiana, it floods out for miles. So we knew what we were in for, and we knew what we needed to design to. We also knew that when the Ohio floods, it takes a lot of stuff downstream. And we knew we had to manage that debris before it got into the marina. We had designed a transient marina, a 1,000-foot dock, that this illustration shows that the existing structures that we had available to us, which are those round cells at the bottom, and that platform there, were already existing. We used that as cover to help protect for debris. We also added a specialty debris deflector to keep things out of marina. And we designed a series of gangways and platforms to allow ADA access down that 40-foot height from the bluff. Here's another illustration of how that was going to work. This, unfortunately, hasn't been built yet and may never get built, but it's designed to accommodate these situations. The construction drawings were built, or designed, and the city pulled out at the last second due to other projects that they had worked on that had gone poorly and had very large cost overruns. This was a disappointment. I would have been really glad to see this one built. We were able to, they were awarded a $1.5 million boating infrastructure grant, and they ended up having to return it. So sometimes it doesn't work even when you plan for the right things. That's about all I have today, but I'd like to entertain questions and start a dialogue with people. Any questions? Yes, ma'am. They're doing that right now. Yes, in fact, for Des Moines, Iowa, I believe they've changed the FEMA flood maps 6 times in the last 20 years. They're trying to keep up, but being large bureaucratic organizations and with an ever-shifting landscape, they're a little behind, and they're trying their best, but they got a long ways to go. No, actually, there's a firm out of, I think it's Northern Ohio, that does that. And they're, the ones that we were using were a series of polyethylene barrels, like 4-foot diameters, with a screen that hung between the two rows of these barrels. It went down about 4.5 feet and went up 2 feet so that it would capture and deflect back into the mainstream anything that came down. Without those screens up and bottom, you'd have a lot of bypassing. And so it's pretty expensive. It's like a couple $1,000 a foot, but it's still better than ruining your marina. Sir?
So all those deflectors were floating?
Yes. Yes, and they were. We actually had them designed to ride up and down those sheet pile cells with a bracket that allowed it to stay floating and not bind up on the sheet pile cells. Yes?
How does that work with the
light? Probably not so much, because it was just screens. And a 4-foot diameter barrel will only do so much of taking off the top energy. It won't take off energy, all the energy. And you have a river that's flowing at 5 knots. So you got lots of stuff going on there. Yes, ma'am. Well, some of the cabling will have to be out of a more specialty cable, like G cable, which is used commonly, originally in coal mines, and it was designed for complete submersion. Other things, you try and move the backflow preventers up to an upland location that it doesn't get flooded very often, and all the electronics. We've been working with seal-tight conduits, and when we have to go into the water with them, they get into special conduits that are capable of withstanding that load. We had a design that allowed the electricity to stay connected throughout, and after we had built it and gone away from the project for a few years. A local superintendent put disconnects into a box in the wet side of the levee, which was unfortunate. So now when we have a flood like we had in 2019, they do have to switch off the transformers and then open up the boxes after the flood and make sure that it's still in good condition. It's not as bad as it could be, but it was something I wanted to have happen. Well, thank you.